In a fireside chat on December 29, 1940, almost a year before Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt urged the United States to serve as the arsenal for Britain and all those resisting the Nazis. Detroit, already the engine of American manufacturing, met FDR's demand, adding tanks, artillery, and aircraft to its production lines, but it didn't always go smoothly. Editor and journalist A.J. Baim tells the story of what happened in his new book called The Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, brings A.J. Baim to our show. And we have, A.J., we have a short clip from FDR's fireside chat.
I want to make it clear that it is the purpose of the nation to build now with all possible speed every machine, every arsenal, every factory that we need to manufacture our defense material. We have the men, the skill, the wealth, and above all, the will. We must be the great arsenal of democracy.
When FDR made that broadcast, did he believe that the United States was bound to end up a combatant in the war?
I don't think he had any doubt about it. And I think that the real genius of that speech is he realized that most people in America, they really didn't think this war was going to touch them. And somehow he needed to convince them, and quickly, to put their best interests aside financially, socioeconomically. Big industry, you know, was just then beginning, to pull out of the Great Depression, and he needed to inspire these people to get on board.
Did he see this as a jobs program?
Among many other things. I think he saw it as a terrific, well, as he said himself, you know, this is, let's see, every man, woman, and child is a part of the greatest undertaking of our American history. And I think he saw on many levels what that it could accomplish.
Did he believe that the United States was going to need a significant percentage of the arms it produced for itself? Because in this case, it's really being offered as help to our allies.
Well, it began that way. And I think that was also a way to sell it to the American public at first. But I think, you know, in all my research, it was pretty clear how prescient he was, how far ahead he was to see this coming before anybody else did.
Was there any concern at that time that Japan would act against the United States?
You know, people have debated for years. And yesterday, just 2 days ago, I was at the FDI our library, excuse me, and listening to a Professor Kai Zerst talk about his new book, and he addressed that subject. And it's just so interesting, everything that was happening in it at the time, and people still argue exactly what FDR knew and what he didn't.
In fact, it's one of the more popular conspiracy theories that survived. Gore Vidal definitely believed that FDR knew and wanted Pearl Harbor so that he could get the United States into the war.
So many people have made that argument. And you know what? There's so many of these stories out there, like, for example, the most controversial part of my book is whether or not, you know, what the Fords knew about, you know, what was happening in their factories and Nazi-occupied territory. And journalists love those stories because they're so sexy, but that doesn't make them true.
How did America's industrial capacity compare with Germany's in 1940?
Well, look at it this way. In the mid-1930s, you know, Germany began rearming and violating the Treaty of Versailles. There was a labor shortage there. I mean, imagine it. In the midst of the Great Depression in Germany, there was a labor shortage where nobody was working anywhere else. And I think that carried on right up to the beginning of the war.
FDR delivered a national emergency on September 8, 1939, a week after the Germans invaded Poland. But most Americans were isolationists at that time.
That's absolutely true. Two of the main characters in the Arsenal of Democracy, my book, I mean, are Charles Lindbergh and Henry Ford. And at the time, it's incredible to think that they were touring the country trying to keep us out of this war. Lindbergh's reasoning was particularly fascinating. He wanted to stay out of this war because he didn't think we could win it, among other reasons. And it's also fascinating to think that those two who were the most outspoken isolationists became, you know, joined as partners to help us win the war after Pearl Harbor.
Henry Ford was 77 in 1940. He had been sympathetic to the Nazis. In fact, in 1938, the Germans awarded Henry Ford their highest decoration for a foreigner, the Grand Cross of the German Eagle. And then a GM executive, James Mooney, also received a similar medal for, quote, distinguished service to the Reich.
As did Charles Lindbergh. Now, whether or not these gentlemen if you would call them that, were sympathizers. It's a very, very complicated issue, and it's something I address in depth in the book.
Well, Henry Ford published the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, so he obviously was anti-Semitic, and I understand Hitler had a copy of one of his books in his office.
Well, again, let's just address how complicated this situation is. You're referring to the book that Henry Ford published, but it didn't have his byline on it. These were articles, anti-Semitic articles, that appeared in the Dearborn Independent, I think, in 1921 and 1922.
Which Ford published.
That he published, and they were anthologized and published in Germany, and Hitler read them and was fascinated by them. But that doesn't necessarily make Henry Ford a Nazi sympathizer. So,
what about Edsel? Did he share his father's political leanings?
A lot of this book is about a father-son team really getting torn apart by the challenges they faced. Henry Ford hated FDR, hated him, refused to meet him. In my research, I found fascinating documents and FDR's writing saying, if Henry Ford will just call me on the phone, we can talk this out. And Henry refused. They finally met in 1938 and made the cover of Newsweek. Edsel, on the other hand, was a great friend of FDR's, an admirer. He threw a birthday party every year on FDR's birthday to raise money for paralysis. So it's just one of the things that really separated father from son.
When FDR suggested that the government work with industry in that broadcast, was everybody in Detroit excited about it?
Absolutely not. Alfred Sloan, who was the president of GM, he denounced this whole issue. As a matter of fact, I have the exact dialogue in the book of when FDR called General Motors President William Knudsen and said, come on down to Washington and be a part of this program. And Knudsen did. He flew down. And his job, the first job, they wanted to build 50,000 airplanes. And he got to the airport and the press said, Mr. Knudsen, can you build 50,000 airplanes? And he said, no, but America can. But he was castigated by people in his company for joining in this war effort early. Of course, as things moved along and Pearl Harbor happened, everything changed.
GM was the largest automaker and largest company in the world at that time. But this is mostly about Ford. Ford, where the head of the company hated FDR. So how did that happen?
You mean how did it happen that Ford
that
is at
Ford
the center,
winds up being the
center of this specific book? Well, there's a number of reasons. One is because the story of what the Fords undertook during the war really is the best example, illuminates everything that was happening on the home front. If I could sum it up very briefly, I would say Edsel Ford and his right-hand man, Charlie Sorensen, Cast Iron Charlie, great Detroit character, brilliant production engineer, they undertook to build the largest airplane factory in the world, the largest factory under one roof anywhere in the world, to try to turn the biggest, fastest, most destructive bomber in our arsenal at the time into the most mass-produced military aircraft of all time.
Did his father go along with that?
At first, no. Once Pearl Harbor happened, you know, these are very complex characters. Ultimately, though, this is a story about patriotism.
And as you mentioned, just a week after FDR's radio broadcast, Edsel Ford announced that he would build the largest, fastest, and most destructive airplane in the U.S. arsenal in numbers never before dreamed. What was that plane?
Well, it was the B-24 Liberator. And at the time, it was our biggest bomber. And I can't
underestimate. It's the plane on the cover of your book.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, if you open the book, I found the original blueprints, and they're right in the end paper. They're very cool. But I don't want to give the ending away, but I will say.
You mean like who won the war?
Well, listen, it's hard to write a book where people know the ending and make it interesting. And I think so far the reviews have been wonderful. But I forget what I was saying, but.
Well, I was asking about the airplane and how. Who designed it?
It was built by a company called Consolidated. And they were out of San Diego, but they had no ability to mass produce this airplane. When the Fords went to look at it, Edsel Ford flew out to San Diego to see this, and there was this whole gaggle of, you know, reporters following him and asking him questions, and it was very dramatic. And he gets there and he sees the way they're putting this airplane together. And they're taking all the parts outside under the hot sun and trying to build this airplane one by one. Each one was different than the next. And he thought, wait a minute, if we take the principles that we use to make motor cars and apply this to this massive bomber, 56,000 pounds, nothing like this had ever been done before, and everybody in the aviation industry said it couldn't be done.
But obviously it was done. Edsel had proposed all sorts of innovations for the Ford cars that his father had opposed, eventually caved in a few cases and made the cars better. Why did Edsel have to keep on fighting with his father when he proved to be right so often?
Well, very complicated character, Henry Ford. And I think as he was getting older, he got set in his ways. And in the early part of his book, you see Henry Ford emerge from total obscurity, penniless, just almost penniless, very little education, and become, through these brilliant ideas, probably the most famous person in the world and somebody who represented Americanism more than any other figure all over the world. And I think as he got older, because he had so much success, he refused to believe that he could be wrong. And his son was this forward-thinking, modern character.
He didn't want to have the cars any color but black. He continued to insist that there be a hand crank in the front to get the car going. All sorts of things that Edsel was pushing against.
It's true. Edsel was also forward-thinking in ways that really didn't have much to do with specifically with the motor cars. He saw the way corporations were modernizing. He wanted college-educated executives, which was, not necessarily the norm. He wanted an accounting department. He even envisioned, automobiles with engines in the back, 30 years before this revolutionized auto racing.
My guest is A.J. Baim, B-A-I-M-E. His book, The Arsenal of Democracy, FDR Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. The Battle of Britain, fought in the air, had taken place in the summer and autumn of 1940. Had Churchill or FDR realized beforehand that the air war would be critical?
Oh, I have no doubt, no doubt. And it's really, I gave a talk at the 92nd Street Y on Friday, and I was showing some slides, and I put a picture of Hitler up on the wall, and I called him an evil genius, and people in the room got upset with me. And what I should have done was I was quoting somebody, and I should have used the quote.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that there's any doubt that he saw how the airplane could change warfare before many others did. I mean, he created the first fully crafted Air Force.
Also developed rocketry, or at least the German military did. The U.S. dropped almost 1.5 million tons of bombs during World War II. Do you know how much of that was dropped by B-24s?
I don't have those figures. I can tell you that the B-24 was, and I'm giving away the ending, the most mass-produced military aircraft. It still is today. Stephen Ambrose wrote a wonderful book about the B-24 called The Wild Blue. And that's another book that really emphasizes the importance, because it wasn't the military's favorite airplane. It was very difficult to fly. But I think in the end, it was quite successful at what it tried to do.
Edsel promised to manufacture one bomber every hour. Did he know that the factories could actually meet that demand?
Well, I think that he was inspired by his father's legacy. And as a matter of fact, if I could open the book and, an epigraph right at the front. I don't have it with me. But it's basically Henry Ford saying, I refuse to believe that anybody knows anything enough about anything in this world to say what is and what is not possible. And I think that that's the spirit that Edsel was raised with.
How did workers at Ford factories respond to the commitment for that much labor?
It was incredibly difficult because, they had to train these people to make bombers. As a matter of fact, my grandfather-in-law worked at the factory, and he saved all his manuals, and he showed me what it was like to learn how to be mechanics and how to build these bombers. During the war, of course, the military was drafting tremendous amounts of this labor away from the factory, so they would train these people, and then they would disappear. So there was one instance in the book where a guy who ran the Cadillac factory, they were making bomb sites inside this factory, very high-tech, complicated gyroscopes. And they were so short on labor that this guy actually went out on the streets of Detroit and recruited prostitutes, brought them into his factory, showed him showed them films of how to make these incredibly complex gyroscopes, and they succeeded.
The Willow Run factory near Detroit produced 650 B-24s per month in 1944. In 1945, Ford was making 70% of all the B-24s. With that kind of production rate, how reliable were the finished planes?
I interviewed a lot of people who flew on those planes.
I mean, you said they were difficult to fly, but was that just because they hadn't been designed perfectly well?
Here's what I can say. The first prototype of this airplane was built at the end of 1938, okay? By 1939, they put this thing into production. And by 1940, you know, a couple of dozen had been built, and then they started to really mass produce this thing. And the military would fly these airplanes and say, this isn't working right, this isn't working right. And so the plane was constantly changing throughout the world, which made it extraordinarily difficult to mass produce. But I, in my research, I found that the plane got better and better and better and cheaper to make.
In a current situation, the newest addition to the U.S. Air Force is the F-35 built by Lockheed Martin, over budget and underperforming. How did Ford do with the B-24 70 years ago? Did it bring it in at the proposed cost?
I believe they did, and the cost of the airplane went down. As all of these factories in Detroit were making these things, they figured out how to make them better and better. So at the beginning, when Lindbergh first came and flew the Ford-built 24, because Lindbergh was, you know, he's a character in the book. He worked at Willow Run at the Ford bomber plant, frankly, because he was blackballed and no one else would hire him. When he first flew this airplane, he called it, quote, the worst piece of aircraft construction I have ever flown in my life. But by the end, the critics were coming in and saying these were decent airplanes.
What happened to car making while Detroit was directed toward the war effort?
It disappeared, with the exception of course, the Jeep and any motor vehicle that could be used for the war effort.
Now, these planes originally were being made to be sent to England to fight Germany. What happened after Pearl Harbor?
Well, after Pearl Harbor, by the time Pearl Harbor occurred, let me put it like this, Detroit had already become the most important location of war production in our country. So,
was it still the fifth largest city in the country?
Well, during the war, it went from the fourth to the third, because you had this massive migration of people into the city to make these Jeeps, you know, on these assembly lines, to make, you know, the Chrysler tank arsenal, dozens and thousands of tanks made by Chrysler Corporation. So all this labor had to come from somewhere. One of my favorite parts of the book is at this Willow Run bomber plant, because of rationing, labor couldn't get to this airplane factory. So people were living in shanty towns all around this huge factory by the thousands. At one point, a nun found a woman in a shanty town, you know, who was holding a baby in a newspaper, trying to keep it warm. And FDR had this idea to create something that he called Bomber City, and they created an entire city, put it next to this airplane factory to house these workers. Can you imagine something like that happening today?
Despite his image as a champion of average Americans, FDR had to intervene to support management against workers in the 30s. Did the government pressure workers or management in the 40s?
The labor situation was extremely contentious.
Well, people are really being pushed hard to make something that they were totally unprepared to make. They all understood how to make cars if they were living in Detroit, but now they're doing something totally different.
I think it was extremely difficult. But also, the task of creating the arsenal of democracy, the task of all the change that was happening on the home front put an extraordinary amount of pressure on all walks of life in the country. And that's why, for example, in the book, there's a whole chapter I dedicate to the Detroit race riot in 1943. Extremely, you know, a great embarrassment to FDR. I think 32 people were killed, a lot of them by our own policemen.
And what led to the race riot?
It had never occurred that African Americans and white people were pushed with such, into living in such close quarters, working on factories right next to each other. You know, the war really forced the issue of integration, and Detroit's, because it was such an important locus of wartime production, it became extremely overcrowded, and it became a hotbed for all of the problems in America at the time were really festering right in Detroit, and that's where the race riot came from.
And now Detroit, of course, is underpopulated, but it's almost totally segregated.
Well, when I go through Detroit now, it just blows my mind. And to me, the greatest symbol of what's happening in Detroit right now, you know, my book talks about this bomber plant, the Willow Run bomber plant, as a way to illuminate everything that was happening in Detroit and across, you know, the country. Right now, that airplane factory is being leveled by the wrecking ball. And you can, you know, you drive there now and you see it, just this huge pile of rubble. This factory that meant so much to our country at the time. And there's actually this wonderful man named Dennis Norton who's raised money to take a small piece of the factory and turn it into a very important World War II museum. And I applaud his effort.
Why has the auto industry pretty much abandoned Michigan? They've gone south because they could get cheaper labor and gone to Mexico, but they've also gone to Canada where wages are pretty high.
I'm trying to think of how to answer that question. It's such a complicated question. That's a book all on its own.
Mm-hmm. That's maybe your next book.
I would love that.
This book is called The Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And my great thanks to A.J. Baim for being our guest today.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.